Hello and welcome to another episode of What Does the Science Say? The podcast brought to you by the team behind the environmental monitoring magazine AWE International and sponsored by Polyscience Temperature Control Equipment. We're here to challenge widely held beliefs about the air, water and environment by offering something that's often missing, the science. So every fortnight we'll discuss a current topic, and after we present the evidence, or invite a wonderful guest speaker to present their research on it, we'll come to a verdict, myth or reality. I'm Kerry Jones, Senior Editor of AWE.
And I'm Anna Martins, Editor of AWE, and this is What Does the Science Say? Today we'll be discussing water filters and asking if they are an effective way to remove PFAS from our drinking water. And to help us reach a verdict, we will be speaking with chemists Andrew Knight and Ryan Davis from Sandia National Laboratories, a federally funded research and development centre in the US, who are researching this very issue.
But as ever, before we get started, let's set the scene. The Centre for Disease Control and Prevention says that PFAS are in the blood of 97% of Americans. Clear? Colourless and odourless, PFAS are really hard to detect, but they make an enormous impact around the world. They're a collection of man-made chemicals. Some organisations say there are around 5,000, some say 15,000. It really depends on how you categorise them. But they generally fall into six groups of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFOAs, PFOSs, etc. We're generally referring to them as PFAS. Now, they were invented in the 40s by bonding carbon with fluorine, and researchers soon discovered they were excellent barriers against heat, oil and water, making them ideal for protective coatings. So soon they were everywhere, and I mean absolutely everywhere. You would have to live an extremely isolated life not to come into contact with PFAS. If you just think of stain-proof furnishings and carpets, waterproof clothing, non-stick cooking pans, greaseproof paper, makeups, shampoos, welly boots, pizza boxes, tents, even toilet roll. That's still only a few ways that they're used.
But after this period of invention, scientists started realizing that the chemicals were not breaking down in the environment. In fact, the carbon-fluorine bond is so strong that it can take hundreds or even thousands of years for certain types to degrade, earning them the nickname forever chemicals. And in the meantime, they accumulate, either in landfills and in soils, and even in our own bodies, from being in the foods we eat and just widespread across our public water systems. PFASs can contribute to a vast range of health issues, including cancers, immune deficiencies, hormone and metabolic problems, and more. The Royal Society of Chemistry says the biggest danger is when we ingest these chemicals. So while multiple governments are racing to bring in laws, right now, today, how can we stop PFAS entering our bodies? Well, many people use water filter taps and jugs to try and ward off these forever chemicals, but they're not designed for PFAS, not yet anyway. But that is changing. I think it's time we brought in our guests.
So hello, Andrew and Ryan. Thank you so much for joining us. You're very welcome here on What Does the Science Say?
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So can we start with a brief introduction about you both? Tell us a little bit about your role and what you do.
Yeah, so my name is Andrew Knight. I'm a chemist here at Sandia National Labs. We're in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I have a background in trying to understand kind of metal separations. And in grad school, I did a lot of work trying to separate actinide species. And in doing so, I learned a lot about how to separate different types of materials and different types of chemical species. And so when the problem of PFAS contamination continued to become more in the public light, it was a problem that I felt could be an interesting one to try to tackle from a scientific perspective, and using some of the understanding I have of separations, try to understand how we could specifically try to remove PFAS from different types of matrices. And so that's kind of what brought me to where I am right now. At Sandia, we've only recently started to get involved in this. The Sandia National Lab is a part of the Department of Energy National Lab system. The other national labs also have some PFAS work going on. But from Sandia perspective, it's kind of been a new pet project for some of us here.
Thank you. And Ryan, yourself?
Yeah, my name is Ryan Davis. I'm an environmental and physical chemist at Sandia National Labs. I have a background in environmental and atmospheric chemistry and also understanding oxidation processes. So when I joined Sandia, this was a project, there were projects on PFAS that really fit my background well, and I've been able to get involved in focusing on, you know, environmental remediation, trying to understand and detect PFAS and how to remove it.
Amazing. So, Andrew, I believe that you've said your mission is to tackle the PFAS problem, and I understand you've been developing a new material. Can you tell us a bit more about this research then?
Yeah, so we have some research going on at Sandia looking at different materials that could be used for filtration. So what we're trying to do is try to create new materials that are both economically viable, right? There's many ways you can remove PFAS from water, but it has to be something that can be actually deployed at a larger scale. And so we're looking at kind of modifying some activated carbon materials to try to increase some adsorption capacity and maybe hope to improve specificity, right? Because one major challenge with PFAS removal from water systems is the limits that you need to remove PFAS down to are so low that in most, if not all cases, you have so much more competing natural organic material. And so the materials get rapidly overwhelmed by that natural organic material. And so you need to find some way to selectively remove the PFAS so that your sorbent material can be used for longer periods of time and be more effective. So those are kind of the goals. We're still pretty early on in our research and development in this area, but we have some results that are showing pretty good results in terms of adsorption capacity. But we have yet to really focus in on that specificity, which I think is probably really key. Yeah.
Absolutely. I can understand that that would be the very difficult part of the PFAS problem there.
Yeah.
So thank you. And Ryan, we've heard that MIT says that common methods like using activated carbon or reverse osmosis actually work well to filter PFAS. So why do we need a new material and how is it different to what we would find at home?
So things like activated carbon work pretty well to get PFAS down to low concentrations. Some of the EPA recommended guidelines right now are so low that activated carbon alone doesn't really seem to get us there yet. We're talking, I think the EPA or the United States EPA recommended guideline was down to 4 parts per quadrillion for certain PFAS. And that's at such a low concentration that even with fairly effective sorbents like activated carbon, there's still an equilibrium concentration that we see that's still above that limit. So we're trying to get it increased specificity and also increase adsorption capacity down where on a first pass, like say if you had a filter under a sink, you could get down to that 4 parts per quadrillion without much effort.
Absolutely. That's a very small number as well. I can imagine it's incredibly difficult to get it down.
It is.
Yeah, there's some interesting language in the scientific literature about when that ruling came out that is just the number that was proposed at that time is just so exceedingly low that has its own major challenges associated with it.
Can I ask, sorry, what is the average rate then? So if you're looking at drinking water, I know obviously it's going to vary where you are, but what's before you start filtering, what levels are you looking at?
That's a great question. I think that would be highly variable. I mean, generally speaking, it seems as if the places that don't have PFAS reported are places that haven't been sampled. It seems like the more you sample, the more you find it. So I don't know what kind of like a national average in the US would look like. I'm not sure what it would look like in the UK either, but I think that would be highly variable upon your site, how close you are to various industrial complexes or military complexes and stuff like that.
Is there any figure just for a comparison? Are we talking like, say, like you said, if it's 4 parts per, what was it?
Quadrillion.
Yeah, that's a big, that in itself is hard to process. If it's 4 parts per quadrillion, obviously that's incredibly low. I mean, are we looking at 100 parts per quadrillion?
Yeah, so the 4 part per quadrillion number is a health advisory level. That's not necessarily an actionable limit. There's a lot of research that's going on trying to understand the actual kind of exposure thresholds for various health effects. That isn't necessarily well established. There's, I think, certain types of illnesses and diseases that are very much very likely linked to PFAS exposure, but understanding those kind of low end exposures and how that can lead to the health effects is not a very easy thing to determine. Yeah. So I think that number is one to just be very safe, basically.
Yeah. I think that's why it's so low, is there's so much uncertainty right now. The health advisory limit is 4 parts per quadrillion, in part because of the uncertainty. I think we just don't know if you really need it that low to avoid any health complications.
I suppose the experts would all really want them that number to be zero, so as close to zero as possible.
And I think the new language, the US EPA came out with some new rulings last week. The new language was basically like, there is no amount of exposure to, I think it was PFOA, PFOS, and maybe a couple others that doesn't carry a risk.
Of right? course, yeah.
These are purely synthetic chemicals. There's no biological purpose. And so the exposure in your body to these chemicals carries risk.
So moving that on then, you said you've had positive results from this. So how much PFAS has this new material been able to remove? And could you give us a visual idea of that? Like, say, for example, if you were to apply it to perhaps a reservoir or something on a large scale, how quickly would you be able to filter that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So like I said, we're pretty early on in our testing capabilities. We're currently just testing pretty clean water with just different PFAS compounds. And we do see removal of greater than 99% in the concentrations we've tested. But the real challenge, as I mentioned before, is going to be more complex waters where you have different types of organic material. So we're doing like an in-depth screening analysis to evaluate how well these materials perform, and they perform quite well. But that will be very much challenged by more complicated waters. And so that's where trying to understand the actual kind of bonding interactions and the mechanism of adsorption become really important, because you could try to leverage and understand the differences between PFAS compounds compared to some of the other natural organic material that would behave similar, but there might be some distinct differences that you could try to leverage. So I will say, like, we're having positive results, but there's a long way to go.
Sure. So am I right in thinking that the aim is to have something that works for domestic settings as well as very, very large scale use? And how are you looking to achieve that?
Yeah, so I think domestic settings would possibly be an easier one, because from a usability standpoint, you could foresee having some sort of water filter under your sink. The reason why I think that's easier is because you're relying on the if you have city water or municipal water, you're relying on the water treatment facility to remove the bulk of the things that could be problematic for competing with PFAS on your system. And so it'd be like a final removal system so that you minimize PFAS exposure at the drinking water level or at the end use level. I think the challenges associated with that are you then have material spread across households or across facilities which are now contaminated with PFAS, and understanding how to dispose of that or degrade the PFAS on those materials is a whole nother body of work that has complex science associated with it. But I think that would be, from a material standpoint, a much easier situation. Granted, in that setting, you also don't have a way to verify PFAS is not there, right? People don't have LCMS systems at their house to check to make sure there's no PFAS in their water before they drink it. So there would be kind of there's a little bit less of a safety net or a security verification there. But from a material standpoint, that could be easier. On a large scale standpoint, I think people are doing that. I'm not sure what the status of it in the UK is. There are places in the US that do have activated carbon involved in their system to try to remove PFAS. I'm not sure how they're actively monitoring that, but there are labs scattered throughout the US where they do kind of the EPA method to verify the water has or doesn't have PFAS in it. So there's a number of different ways materials like these could be deployed.
Yeah, I think in the UK, we're struggling to manage all kinds of waste, pollutants, plastics. I think it's coming. I think we're definitely monitoring, but I'm not sure any action is being taken right now, none that I'm aware of. So that's quite an interesting point you made about waste there. So once you have this filter, if that's at home and you don't want to bin it, send it to landfill, leach into the soil, you don't want to burn it into the air. So with this new material, have you thought about how that would work, how you would manage that?
It's actually easier to remove it through adsorption, like we're talking about, than it is to kind of to degrade it, is what we're finding. That's kind of one of the grand challenges with PFAS removal, is how do you completely get rid of it? Because these materials are designed, or They're just very hard to break down. They're very resilient. And some of the most effective processes are very energy intensive to break these PFAS materials down to just benign fluoride. In terms of, you know, if people had something under their sink as a filter, I think a process I could envision would be, you know, people sending these back to a centralized facility where once it wouldn't be practical for anyone to try and break down PFAS themselves in their house and shouldn't be trying to, probably. I can imagine a centralized facility where people send spent filters back. Of course, that becomes an issue of compliance because just like we're supposed to recycle batteries, they end up in a landfill anyway. So compliance would be an issue, but I think it would still be, we'd be iteratively moving towards a better solution.
From the Sandia side of things, we've tried to focus on kind of materials for adsorption. We're also trying to focus kind of leveraging Ryan's analytical capabilities, advanced detection techniques, whether that's, I mean, right now we're focusing on water, but you could foresee improving soil detection. I think that's a big thing. And then just focusing on different types of degradation pathways. I mean, there's a lot of work that could go on in that area. In many cases, degradation can lead to just the creation of shorter chain PFAS compounds. You break some of the easier bonds to break and you just make a bunch of short chain PFAS, but really focusing in on how to break that carbon fluorine bond is something that would have a huge impact on kind of the future of PFAS degradation. And one thing that we've been kind of simultaneously working on is both PFAS adsorption onto these materials, but also desorption. It's an important process for kind of detection mechanisms as well. Solid phase extraction is what's used for the EPA method. You concentrate PFAS onto material and you desorb it in a smaller volume to increase that concentration factor. So in doing so, you could foresee then kind of what Ryan was describing, a situation where if the users were compliant and sent back to facilities, you could desorb it. If you know a good way of desorbing all the PFAS from your material, desorb it, you could reuse that material, but then you still have to worry about that kind of concentrated waste stream. And that might be something that would be managed either through a degradation process or stored. I don't know.
So for your own opinion then, so loads of people already buy water filters, especially in the US, probably even more so than here in the UK, you know, to filter out, like you said, chlorines, metals, just dirt and plastics, other things you don't want in there. Do you think we should be buying home filters for PFAS, or should we be waiting for these larger scale projects to come into effect, bearing in mind that could be years?
My personal opinion, I guess, would be it wouldn't hurt to have a home filter at home, a water filter at home. I mean, granulated activated carbon, which is probably the main component of most water filters anyway, is effective at removing PFAS. If you have the ability to do one extra step to clean your water a bit more before you drink it, that's a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we have water filters. Our home is drink tap water. We do have a water softener, so we have a reverse osmosis filter. We've lived places where the water just didn't have a great taste, so we use the Brita water filters, and I think it's such a common thing for people to do that if there was a convenient in-home water filter, I could see there being a lot of interest, and there's really no harm.
Yeah. One thing I was actually surprised by yesterday, the New York Times had an article talking about PFAS and forever chemicals, and they mentioned that 20% of people's exposure to PFAS is through water. And I was actually surprised it was only 20%. So this is definitely not just a water problem. It's something that we need to think about from an air quality standpoint, from like material standpoint, what you wear, what you eat. And so it's a big problem. Yeah. Not to make it scary, but yeah.
So if we look at what's at stake, if we don't start sort of backing research projects like this, or if we find that it works, but we just don't roll it out in time, you know, surely as water and air flow, it's going to take cooperation to fix this, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. In terms of what's at stake, I think it's just the continued accumulation of PFAS, both in the environment and in the bodies, right? I was giving a talk a couple months ago and looked into kind of the biological half-lives of some of these PFAS compounds and the environmental half-lives. And they are, I mean, they're called forever chemicals for a reason. I mean, they do eventually on a geologic scale degrade, I guess. But if we don't manage the problem now, it's just going to continue to accumulate to levels that are just going to be more and more problematic.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And it's definitely something that Europe is looking to actually tackle more and more now. We've recently had an EU plenary vote on the Urban Wastewater Treatment Directive, and that's got a massive PFAS clause in it now. They want to start targeting that. And they've tested actually EU leaders' blood and found that it contains forever chemicals and things. So there's definitely that pressure now of these are forever chemicals. They do last a long time. And what are we going to do about it, really? So thank you so much for speaking with us today. I think we've had a great conversation and it's been wonderful to hear more about the amazing work that you're both doing.
Thank you so much. Okay, it's that time again. That was quite a technical discussion. So after all that, Anna, tell me, when it comes to PFAS, are drinking water filters worth it? Is this a myth or a reality?
So, whilst the technology seems to be going in the right direction, by the sounds of things, the safe levels of PFAS are set to unworkably tiny concentrations. So even though some of these filters and techniques promise to remove a portion of them, is it actually enough to make a significant difference when it seems like we're exposed to PFAS from all directions? Also, Andrew mentioned that they are currently testing these filters in the lab with relatively clean water. And in real-world scenarios, we know that concentrations and amounts of PFAS can vary greatly depending on the area you are in. That uncertainty means we just don't know how effective these filters will be in reality. I mean, they mention in the US that the limit is 4 parts per quadrillion. And for reference, it looks like in parts of the UK, the limit deemed acceptable is actually 100 parts per quadrillion. Maybe a large scale, this may make a difference. And once we manage to overcome the issue of specificity that Andrew mentioned. But until then, I'm going to say that it remains a myth that PFAS filters are worth it, as they just aren't effective enough, or probably even affordable enough to become a reality for the wider population yet.
You know, I thought we were going to disagree on this, but actually I'm 100% with you. I really think it's quite exciting, and the idea that you can do this on a really large scale, municipal waters and reservoirs, I mean, our water flows all around the world. So if one country is doing it, another country isn't, we've still got a problem. So I think applying that on the large scale, like they said, is so much more effective. I'm certainly not going to be rushing out to buy a PFAS filter myself. I have looked online. They're incredibly expensive. I don't think many people could even afford them, absolutely, like exactly as you said. But yes, hopefully, as Andrew said, not too long. But when it comes to domestic drinking water filters, yes, I agree. Myth.
This episode of What Does the Science Say is brought to you by Polyscience and their award-winning line of temperature control equipment. For over 60 years, Polyscience has been helping the world innovate, create, and reach their full potential in labs across the world. Chillers, water baths, circulating baths, and more. Quality, reliability, durability, and being environmentally conscious are the core values behind every Polyscience product. Find out more at polyscience.com.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thanks again so much to Andrew Knight and Ryan Davis from Sandia for their contributions, and thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to the podcast and share it with friends, colleagues, anybody who's interested, and please do tell us if there's anything you'd like to hear more about. For more in-depth coverage of all of these topics on environmental monitoring, do head to aweinternational.com. And from me, it's goodbye.
Yeah, bye.